It's Tuesday, August 19th. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Today, a new effort to close the achievement gap. A group opposed to Native American nicknames reverses itself on the War Road Warriors, and more Minnesota sounds and voices. First, Medtronic officials say they remain committed to purchasing Covidien, a medical device maker based in Ireland. The deal would allow Medtronic to move its legal headquarters from Fridley to Dublin to take advantage of Ireland's lower corporate tax rate. Proposed federal legislation would prohibit such deals, and the Treasury Department is also considering restrictions. But in a conference call with investors today, Medtronic CEO Omar Ishrak said if the purchase is completed, the company will still pay a significant amount of taxes in the U.S.
We will continue to pay federal, state, and local income taxes on all U.S. earnings, as well as Social Security taxes, property taxes, and the medical device tax.
Also today, Medtronic reported net income for the company's first quarter of $871 million. That was a drop of 9% from the same period a year ago, as expenses rose faster than sales. Minneapolis-based Target says it's now keeping about half of its U.S. stores open later. The company says it has been hearing from customers who want to shop later. Now, testing the idea in a pilot program, the company says it's keeping the doors open 1 to 2 hours later at nearly 1,000 locations. Target spokeswoman Erica Winkles says closing times vary by location.
It's a very store-by-store basis. Target really took a look at that data and customized the approach across the country. So we took a look at where guests were telling us that they wanted to shop a little bit later, and so that's why we made the change.
Target stores have typically closed at 10 p.m. on most days and 9 p.m. on Sundays. The added hours may help the company compete with Walmart, which keeps most of its stores open around the clock. Target has struggled to boost growth at stores in both the U.S. and Canada. The condition of Minnesota's corn and soybean crops slipped a little bit last week, despite rains that helped the dry areas of the state. Mark Stile reports.
The state's crops have been in very good condition for most of the growing season, and a late-season dry spell has yet to take a significant toll in farm fields. 68% of the corn crop is rated in good to excellent condition, down 2 points from last week. Soybean condition dropped 1 percentage point to 64% good to excellent. Although there were heavy rains in some locations last week, most of the state saw less than a half inch of precipitation. As a result, cropland in some areas continues to dry out. 43% of the state now has short or very short topsoil moisture. But even with the dryness, most cornfields in Minnesota and across the nation are still expected to yield a good crop, and corn prices remain at lows not seen since 2010 because the crop is expected to be so big. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals says state officials must explain why they granted a water permit to a large hog feedlot in Todd County. Here's Elizabeth Dunbar.
Last year, the Gourley Brothers Company applied for and received a permit that would allow its farm to pump up to 8 million gallons of groundwater a year. But neighbors who oppose the large feedlot say the Department of Natural Resources didn't do its homework before issuing the permit. The neighbors have complained about problems with bacteria and water pressure in their wells. Now a three-judge panel says it can't decide whether the DNR made a good decision because DNR officials didn't provide evidence showing why the groundwater withdrawal was justified. The court is asking the DNR for more information. The Humane Society of the United States joined the neighbors in the legal challenge. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Cargill Foundation has made a $2 million donation to support the Early Childhood Education Program at the YWCA of Minneapolis. Peter Cox has more.
The $2 million gift will support the YWCA's Early Childhood Education Programs and a campaign to increase the reach of its programs and to update and renovate YWCA facilities. In recognition of the donation, the YWCA is renaming the Children's Center at downtown the Cargill Early Learning Center. According to its website, the Cargill Foundation has two main focus areas, K-12 education for children and early childhood nutrition programs from pre-kindergarten through sixth grade. Foundation President Scott Portnoy said in a statement that his foundation is committed to helping close the achievement gap and improve early childhood education. The YWCA of Minneapolis says last year 73% of children enrolled in the downtown Early Childhood Education Center were children of color, and more than half of the children lived in low-income households at or below the poverty level. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Brave New Workshop is expanding in downtown Minneapolis. The company, which runs an improv theater, a school, and corporate training services, has purchased a second building on Hennepin Avenue across the street from its main stage. Co-owner John Sweeney says the new building will offer more than five times the classroom space as its previous location.
And it enables us to really create a campus feel where we can have our students, our event guests, our theater guests, and our corporate training guests all in the same one-block vicinity.
Until recently, Brave New Workshop leased a space in Uptown. Circus performer Dudley Riggs founded the Improv Theater back in 1958. The leader of a Native American environmental group has begun a long horseback ride to protest a proposed oil pipeline across northern Minnesota. We go back to Elizabeth Dunbar.
Winona LaDuke plans to ride the proposed route of Enbridge's Sandpiper pipeline. The line would carry crude oil from North Dakota across northern Minnesota to Superior, Wisconsin. LaDuke is executive director of Honor the Earth. She says the pristine area of Minnesota, known for its clean lakes, shouldn't be put at risk for oil spills.
So we should be able to keep an eye on the pipelines at all times. This area is not keep an eye on pipeline area. These are remote areas that no one is going to go to.
Minnesota regulators are still scrutinizing the proposed route. Enbridge has said new pipelines are much safer, lowering the risk of spills. And the company has also said rerouting the lines, as opponents have suggested, would be too expensive. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A group that criticizes racism in sports has dropped an effort to force the War Road, Minnesota School District to change the nickname of its sports teams. The National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media was threatening a lawsuit if War Road did not get rid of the Warriors' name and logo. But the group changed course after hearing from Henry Boucher. Boucher, who is Ojibwe, led War Road to the state championship in high school hockey in 1969. He also won a silver medal in the Olympics and played in the NHL. Henry Boucher joined Kathy Werzer this morning.
Say, I noticed on Facebook, Henry, that there's an effort, there's a page, Save the War Road Nickname, has about 2,400 people signed up. What did you tell the group yesterday, the National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media, about not changing the nickname?
We were a little devastated on Friday when we got the letter, but I think, after yesterday and after a lot of dialogue about Indian names and logos and the history of War Road, I think the National Coalition was a little bit embarrassed about going after one of their own.
Now, I understand you did a little education yesterday, if I could use that word. Explain what you said.
Well, basically, I gave them a history of War Road and the Lake of the Woodville, and how during the migration, the Ojibwe and the Anishinaabe, moved from the Atlantic Ocean over a 500-year period, and we ended up in on Lake of the Woods. There's several other bands up there, 28 bands around Lake of the Woods, but in the 1600s, and 1700s, and, we fought the Sioux up there over 100 years, and, our blood and of our ancestors are there, and it was Namaypak, one of my great-great uncles that actually sold the land to the War Road School, and he was a clever man, because, he asked at that time that we instill the name Warriors, and they didn't know all of that rich tradition that we had up there, and certainly abruptly changed their minds about having War Road change their name. So, a history lesson and the compassion that we have for the War Road Warriors and the logo that the Indian Parent Committee and the Indian community designed was epic, and they realized that they made a mistake.
So I understand that the National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media asked you to join the group.
They did, and I was honored because I think they do some great work. I think they need to do a little better job in investigating their subjects. And just like World, you know, I think they were a little short on that part of their process. But don't get me wrong, there's some adverse names out there that we need to deal with.
Say, I'm a native of Minneapolis. You're native of War Road. I always wanted to know this. You mentioned earlier in our conversation about the history of the nickname, the Warriors. What about the history of the name War Road? I've never known that.
Southwest part of Lake of the Woods is where War Road's located at. Look, Lake of the Woods extends up into Manitoba and Ontario, and it's 60 miles long, or it's 90 miles long, up to Kenora, Ontario. You can go by water. And it's 60 miles wide, and there's 14,600 islands on that lake. It's a beautiful lake. But at the southwest corner where Ward is located used to be a war trail from Lake of the Woods into the Dakotas, where the Sioux used to come down and battle with the Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, and then we would in turn, you know, go battle them down that war trail, and that's how War become that name, War Road.
Ah, all right. Thank you for educating me, Henry Boucher.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on, Kathy.
Henry Boucher and Kathy Werzer this morning on Morning Edition. Former Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback has laid out an ambitious plan to close the achievement gap in Minneapolis and St. Paul that's leaving minority students academically unprepared. The organization he leads, a coalition of civic and business leaders called Generation Next, wants to help children in three key social areas. Higher education reporter Alex Friedrich talked about it with Stephen John.
When we talk about the achievement gap, what are we talking about specifically?
Well, in the broadest terms, it's the difference in performance between white students and students of color. I mean, it can be measured in any number of ways, graduation rates, test scores, students who go on to college. Now, there has been some improvement on some of these measures in recent years, but Minnesota still has one of the country's widest gaps in student performance. Test scores for students of color, for example, are as much as 30 points lower than those of white students.
We've heard about lots of initiatives in the past designed to close the gap. What's new about all of this today?
Ryback says this is the first time Minnesota has had such a broad coalition focused on the same things and with such a sense of urgency. Now, he's rallied together leaders from business, education, nonprofits, and the state. Today, he called the achievement gap the shame of the community and says it's the biggest issue we have.
So how does the Generation Next coalition propose closing this gap?
Well, they've got three initial goals. The first is comprehensive health screening. They want all three-year-olds to be screened for health problems and disabilities, you know, such as speech impediments, which can hold them back academically. Then they can get therapy and support. Second, they want reading proficiency by third grade. Now, schools' reading tutors would receive training in promising tutoring techniques so they can more effectively help students learn how to read. And then the third is better guidance counseling. It's about getting students to think past high school, to give them a goal and a plan so they can, you know, move on to college or training or a career. Each child would receive close attention from caring adults trained to help them write and follow a plan, you know, to get them smoothly into college or a career. Now, a lot of students lay out plans as early as middle school, but I heard they need a caring adult to stay with them and help them stick to it.
So aren't a lot of these types of things already in place in schools?
Right, they are. But much of the problem isn't that schools, you know, of course, aren't doing these things. The problem is that standards and access are uneven. Ryback says what's necessary is better coordination and a focus on what works. That means measuring performance and looking at the data and then taking action there.
When does it start?
Well, some of it already has. The coalition is going to try out some of its ideas in pilot schools and then see what works and what doesn't. And Ryback says Generation Next will likely write a report on the matter at some point, but he suggested the work was open-ended, and he didn't give me any timeline for when he'll assess how successful it's been.
Do we know how much it's going to cost?
He didn't say. Now, we're talking about a lot of agencies here and a lot of organizations who are helping out, and they're all sort of doing their share. He says he's not standing up there saying, hey, you know, I want a big fat check to solve this problem. He says it will take some investments, but it'll mostly be about people helping out, doing things smarter and in a more coordinated way.
All right. Thanks, Alex.
You're welcome.
Alex Friedrich and Stephen John on Monday's All Things Considered. And speaking of Stephen, he introduces today's Minnesota Sounds and Voices.
Manet Fire of Minneapolis was homeless for some of the coldest months of last winter. At one point, desperation drove her to seek shelter in a rental storage unit. Now she has a safe place to live, and she couldn't be happier.
That was the best feeling I ever had in a long time. Yep, freedom from being homeless, freedom from being on the street.
Outreach workers from St. Stephen's Human Services helped Manet find housing. Here's Dan Olson with a new episode of Minnesota Sounds and Voices.
It's home. I don't care if it's small. It's home.
Manet Fire's one-bedroom apartment is in the Little Earth of United Tribes housing complex in South Minneapolis. A tour includes the kitchen with running water and a stove. Late last year, Fire says she got fed up with a landlord she accuses of selling her possessions. She moved in with a granddaughter for a while, but decided she needed a place of her own.
The rent was so unbelievably high. I didn't have that money. So I just gave up.
75-year-old Manet Fire lives on SSI, Supplemental Security Income, the federal program for low-income or disabled people over 65. It amounts to $721 a month. That's enough to buy food and cover some other expenses. It's also enough to rent a storage unit in South Minneapolis, which is where she lived for 2.5 months this past winter.
I had this little box I was living in, 5x10.
Did you have a bed?
No, I slept on a cement floor on some of my blankets.
Living in a rental storage unit in Minnesota and many other states is against the law. Even so, Minneapolis police and a spokesman for the Rental Storage Unit Business Association says while rare, it does happen. Fire's storage unit building had heat. A hallway light supplied some illumination. She used the bathroom on site and bought food at a gas station convenience store across the street. Her spirits hit rock bottom.
It wasn't anything. It was just stay alive, survive, and remember tomorrow's going to always be there.
St. Stephen's Human Resources outreach worker Brianna Shell heard about Fire's situation and offered help. Shell found Fire temporary shelter. She says Fire located the apartment at Little Earth Housing on her own.
I will put myself in their shoes, thinking about the things that Manet's had to deal with in the last couple of months, and I don't know that I could have dealt with it with as much grace as she has.
Manet Fire is Dakota. She was born and raised on the Crow Creek Agency Reservation in South Dakota. Dakota was her first language. She and her sister were punished in grade school for speaking the language.
So we had to sit away from the other kids because we were considered savages.
Manet Fire completed college with a degree in early childhood development. She came to Minnesota nearly 30 years ago to teach. In that time, she survived cancer and several failed marriages with alcoholic or physically abusive husbands. Fire's the mother of 5 children. In a striking turn of events from decades ago, when she was punished for speaking her native language, Fire is now a community resource. She occasionally works in language classes so students can hear her speak Dakota. She recalls the advice from her Dakota grandfather that she says helped her survive being homeless.
Know my language, I know my life, my spirituality, and my grandfather always told us be always ready for tomorrow because there's going to always be a tomorrow and always expect the unexpected, otherwise life's all right.
That's Manet Fire of Minneapolis. Among her few personal possessions are dozens of tablets with handwriting that she says will be the basis for a book about her life. Dan Olson is our Minnesota Sounds and Voices reporter. And I'm Phil Picardi, glad to have you along for today's NPR News podcast. I'll be back with the Wednesday news right here tomorrow.